Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, July 11, 2017, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon, we'll hear an update on the Persuader Rule. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today we are happy to have with us Christopher C. Murray, shareholder at Ogletree Deacons Nash Smoke & Stewart, and our moderator, Karen Harned, Executive Director at the National Federation of Independent Business Small Business Legal Center. I will turn it over to Karen to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Karen. The floor is yours.
Great. Thanks for having us, Laura. So, today we're talking about what is known as Department of Labor's Persuader Rule, a rule that was issued originally in March 2016 under the Obama administration. Like a lot of the rules that came out of the administration late last year or even into 2015, we're seeing a lot of activity in courts where those rules have been challenged in light of new truthfully, deregulatory policies coming out of the new Trump administration. So I'm just going to provide a background of what the Persuader Rule is, and then Chris Murray is going to provide information about what's been going on with the litigation challenging it and rulemaking changes going forward. So the Persuader Rule is what has been called the Persuader Rule. It comes out of a statute, the Labor Management Reporting and Disclosure Act of 1959, and that act requires two sets of parallel reports to be filed. One set is filed by labor organizations, unions. They have to report a wide array of financial information, including, for unions that are organizing the workplace, information on how much they're spending on an organizing campaign. But for employers, businesses who hire labor relations consultants to persuade employees one way or another on organizing and bargaining issues, this typically occurs during a union organizing campaign where an employer might have this outside consultant come in and talk to their employees about benefits and not benefits of unions. They also have to report under this act, they also have to report these relationships, including how much they're spending on these activities. But there was and still is in the LMDRA an important exception that has been known as the advice exception that states, among other things, that it's not that the reporting obligations and applicability of the Labor Management Reporting Disclosure Act is not should not be construed to require any employer, any business, or other person to file a report covering the services that they get by reason of someone giving or agreeing to give advice to the business. So that's why it's called the advice exception. And that has typically provided broad protection for employers to obtain advice on labor matters free of government intrusion in the form of the reporting mandates the Act otherwise provides. Despite that clear statutory policy, in 2016, March 24th, the Persuader Rule was issued under the Obama administration and now broadly redefined what was advice, narrowed it, really, so that for most situations, what used to be advice would no longer be advice and therefore would be reportable. So, among other things, that rule required reporting for any activities with the object of persuading an employee plans to direct or coordinate activities undertaken by supervisors or other employer representatives, that provides material or communications to the employer for dissemination or distribution to employees. So that could even be, a union-free workplace policy, for example, conducts a seminar or supervises conducts a seminar for supervisors or other employee representatives, or develops or implements personnel policies, practices, or actions for the employer. So really, small business owners that I represent, and Chris Murray was our counsel in our lawsuit challenging this persuader rule in court that the Obama administration had put forward, so full disclosure there, we were really concerned that truthfully picking up under the new rule, picking up the phone, calling your attorney because you're wanting, for example, to develop a union-free workplace policy, which is completely legal, or you just had a question about what you can or cannot say to an employer, employee regarding unions, fact questions like that would open you up to the reporting requirements of this act, and more importantly, open up your counsel to that, your outside counsel, which would then mean that they'd have to disclose to Department of Labor not just that they were giving you this advice and how much money they'd spend on that, but also other people that they were advising on labor-related matters, which even the American Bar Association had a problem with for obvious reasons regarding confidentiality. So that is a really top line background on this rule. Chris Murray can fill in more details too, but I wanted to just introduce him quickly to you. He has been a great resource for NFIB. He's, as Laura said, a shareholder in the Indianapolis office of Ogletree Deacons. He went to University of Penn Law School, Case Western undergrad. He was a clerk for Judge Fred Parker on the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. He's been noted as a super lawyer's rising star in 2010 and 2011. And in 2013, he was chair of the Indianapolis Bar Association's labor and employment section. So he is very well versed in employment matters and as I mentioned, has represented NFIB well with his colleagues at Ogletree on this on our suit, NFIB versus Perez, challenging the persuader rule. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to you, Chris.
All right, great. Excuse me. Thank you very much, Karen, and thank you, Laura. As Karen mentioned, I was glad to be part of the team that represented NFIB and very privileged to do that. Along with several other plaintiffs in their lawsuit challenging the persuader rule. I should mention the other plaintiffs in that case were the Texas Association of Business, the National Association of Home Builders, the Texas Association of Home Builders, and the Lubbock Chamber of Commerce. And also wanted to quickly mention that the rest of our team included my colleague who led our team, Jeff Londa, and our co-counsel, Fernando Bustos in Lubbock and Charlie High in El Paso. Appreciate the invitation this afternoon to provide the update on the persuader rule. I also wanted to note for those who want to keep an eye on the various litigations that are challenging or have challenged this rule that there are two other lawsuits out there that you should keep on your radar. The first is the Associated Builders and Contractors versus Perez, which is pending in the Eastern District of Arkansas. That case is handled by our friends at Littler Mendelson and is presently stayed, for those wanting to keep track of these issues, that should still be on your radar. And the other is called LabNet versus Perez, which is pending in the District of Minnesota and involves an association of law firms. That case also is currently stayed. Following up on Karen's summary, I wanted to provide some more background on the LMRDA and its advice exception, including a bit about the history of DOL's interpretation of the advice exception up to the present time. Also briefly describe how the persuader rule changed the DOL's longstanding interpretation, and then we'll share some information about our litigation in Texas challenging the persuader rule and the current status of that litigation. Finally, I'll briefly note that the DOL has recently issued a notice of proposed rulemaking to rescind the persuader rule and what we might expect to happen with that proposal down the road. So turning first with some additional background on the LMRDA for context, That statute arose out of a congressional investigations in the late 1950s. At that time, the labor movement was under intense congressional scrutiny for corruption, racketeering, and other misconduct. And as part of that, at that time, some employers were engaging in a practice of secretly hiring what became known as persuaders to pose as employees and deceptively communicate with fellow employees to try to convince them to vote against unionization. Now, to be clear, these individuals were not themselves employees, but rather were consultants who were secretly hired and paid by the employers to pose as employees and persuade other employees and report back information about them. And that was sort of a quintessential type of union busting. As a result of a congressional investigation and action, in the fall of 1959, President Eisenhower signed into law the LMRDA. Among other things, that statute amended the National Labor Relations Act and provided for certain reporting and disclosures, including of financial transactions and of what became known as persuader agreements. The intent of the intent of the statute were to eradicate or at least reduce the practice of employers hiring persuaders. And at the same time, Congress was careful to exclude from the reporting and disclosure requirements any advice to employers that were given by consultants, including lawyers. Karen already mentioned briefly what these disclosure requirements are, and I'll briefly review those again. The key disclosure requirements that are at issue with the persuader rule include, first, a report required under Section 203A of the statute that employers who have entered agreements or arrangements with persuaders must file a report disclosing those agreements, and that would include agreements with attorneys who are providing persuader activities or engaging in persuader activities. Among other things, those disclosures include the amounts of and dates of payments made under persuader agreements. Employers are required to file these reports on Form LM-10 within 90 days of the end of the employer's fiscal year. The second report that is required under the LMRDA relating to persuader agreements are reports from the labor consultants themselves, which would include attorneys who have entered into arrangements and agreements to provide persuader activities. This is on the DOL's form LM-20. That form must be filed within 30 days after the consultant, including an attorney, enters into a reportable agreement or arrangement to provide persuader activities or engage in persuader activities. Among other things, the LM-20 requires disclosure of the terms of the persuader agreement and the nature of the persuader activities undertaken by the consultant. And then finally, there is the LM-21 form, which also must be filed by the consultant, including attorneys, to engage in persuader activities. That is an annual report that must be filed within 90 days after the completion of the consultant's fiscal year. On that report, there are broader disclosure requirements, as Karen had mentioned, and the consultants, including attorneys, must report receipts from employers in connection with all labor relations advice or services, regardless of the purposes of that advice or those advice or services. They also must report on the LM-21 all disbursements to officers and employees in connection with labor relations advice or services rendered to employees. And we'll turn back to what this means, the labor relations advice or services, in a moment, but the key point is that that is broader and encompasses more activity than simply persuader activity. At the same time as setting out these disclosure requirements, the LMRDA also included in Section 203C what became known as the advice exception or exemption from the LMRDA's reporting requirements. That exception provides that nothing in the section shall be construed to require an employer or other person to file a report covering the services of such person by reason of his giving or agreeing to give advice to an employer. So in short, where a consultant, including attorneys, provided only advice to employers, no reporting obligations were triggered under the LMRDA, and nothing needed to be filed with the DOL. Now, turning to the DOL's interpretation of this advice exception, that remained constant for about five decades. From 1962 up until 2016, the DOL interpreted the advice exception as excluding from the reporting requirements any engagement or agreement or arrangement under which a consultant, including an attorney, merely assisted an employer in responding to union organizing but had no direct contact with employees, and the employer was free to accept or reject the consultant's recommendations. So among the many activities that were considered to fall within the advice exception, that included a lawyer's preparation of documents or speeches that an employer might use during a union organizing campaign. It would include a lawyer's participation in training managers and supervisors through seminars and otherwise, and included lawyers' development of personnel policies and practices, all of which an employer was free to accept or reject and did not involve the lawyers or other consultants' direct contact with employees. That was the settled interpretation, as I mentioned, for about 50 years, up until recently. The Obama administration issued a notice of proposed rulemaking to change the advice exception in 2011, and then following notice and comment, issued its final rule reinterpreting the advice exception on March 24, 2016. Under the new advice exception, which we typically refer to as the persuader rule, DOL changed the interpretation and changed the instructions and contents of the forms LM-10 and LM-20. To accord with its new definition, a new, much narrower definition of the advice exception. And in turn, it greatly expanded the reporting requirements for consultants and employers. The DOL's new rule defines advice in the LMRDA as meaning an oral or written recommendation regarding a decision or a course of conduct. In effect, the new rule overall purports to make advice and persuader activities two mutually exclusive concepts. The new rule provided examples in which a consultant or lawyer would engage in persuader activities even though they did not have direct contact with employees. Specifically, under the new rule, a lawyer or other consultant who didn't have direct contact with employees but who planned the activities or coordinated or directed the activities of supervisors or other employer representatives, provided material or communications to an employer for dissemination to employees, who conducted seminars for supervisors or employer representatives, or who developed or implemented personnel policies for employers. If any of those activities had an object to persuade employees, then they would be defined as persuader activities, even though the lawyer or consultant didn't have direct contact with employees. So under the new persuader rule, all consultants, including lawyers, law firms, and associations who engaged in any of these newly defined persuader activities would be required to file the LM-20 form under the statute, and the LM-21 form, which, as I mentioned before, requires reports of disclosure or reports of receipts from employers in connection with labor relations advice or services. As I noted earlier, this LM-21 form, the annual reporting form, has a much broader disclosure requirement, well beyond merely disclosing persuader activity. Instead, under case law, going back 40 years, that phrase has been interpreted to require a persuader who has engaged even in a single persuader activity to report all of their labor clients, whether they're persuader or non-persuader clients, and all receipts received from all of those clients relating to labor relations advice or services, even if those are not necessarily persuader services or advice. So the annual consultant reporting form basically requires a consultant or a lawyer to disclose all of their clients for labor relations or apparently more generally employment advice, even if that did not involve persuader advice for those specific clients. After the new rule was issued in March of 2016, NFIB and the other plaintiffs I mentioned filed fairly promptly a complaint seeking an injunction in the Northern District of Texas on March 31st. We were joined by a number of states as interveners in that case, including Texas and several other states who ultimately joined that case. In our efforts to seek an injunction, we alleged a variety of claims, including under the Administrative Procedure Act, that the new definition exceeded the DOL's authority under the LMRDA, that the new rule was arbitrary and capricious, that the new rule violated the plaintiffs' and their members' free speech rights and association rights under the First Amendment, that the new rule was void for vagueness under the Fifth Amendment, and that it violated the Regulatory Flexibility Act by failing to properly account for all the costs of the new rule. We were assigned to Judge Cummings in the Northern District of Texas, and he held an evidentiary hearing on June 20th, 2016. Plaintiffs presented evidence, including testimony from 8 witnesses regarding the likely impact of the rule. And the overall effect of that testimony was to show that lawyers were likely to be chilled in providing advice because of the reporting and disclosure requirements, and that clients would be chilled in seeking legal advice because of the expanded disclosure requirements. The district court ruled fairly quickly, and on June 27, 2016, issued a preliminary injunction enjoining DOL on a nationwide basis from implementing the persuader rule. At the heart of the district court's decision was its interpretation that the plain language of the LMRDA prohibited the DOL from issuing the new rule, and essentially the court concluded that the effect of the new rule was to read the advice exemption out of the LMRDA entirely, which went against the obvious intent of Congress. The court ruled in favor of the plaintiffs, finding that they were likely to succeed on all of their claims, both theories under the APA, the First Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, and the Regulatory Flexibility Act. And the court issued a fairly long opinion, about 86 pages. After the court enjoined the implementation of the rule, the parties fairly quickly briefed summary judgment, and on November 16, 2016, the district court converted its preliminary injunction into a permanent injunction and ruled in favor of the plaintiffs and permanently enjoined the persuader rule and set it aside under the APA. Since that time, the DOL has filed a notice of appeal under the prior administration. On January 12, 2017, DOL appealed to the Fifth Circuit. After the new administration came into office, DOL sought a number of extensions for its brief, so that finally its brief was going to be due in June of this year. In the meantime, in late May, on May 23rd, the new Secretary of Labor, Secretary Acosta, interestingly published an editorial in the Wall Street Journal regarding a number of the Obama regulations that were being challenged, and specifically noted that the persuader rule had been set aside by a district court, or had been found, rather, to be invalid. Secretary Acosta wrote that several regulations enacted by the Obama administration have been declared unlawful. One is the persuader rule, which would make it harder for businesses to obtain legal advice. Secretary Acosta went on to note that the Labor Department would engage in a new rulemaking process proposing to rescind the rule. And in fact, just a few days later, on June 12th of this year, DOL issued a new notice of proposed rulemaking to rescind the rule entirely. The status of that currently is the department is continuing to accept public comment and will do so through August 11. So employers and associations and other groups that would be potentially affected by this have several more weeks, about one more month, to submit comments on the department's proposal to rescind the rule. Meanwhile, on the litigation front, the Fifth Circuit, noting that this new notice of proposed rulemaking had been issued, has placed the appeal in abeyance to apparently allow that rulemaking to run its course. The department is required to submit a status report to the Fifth Circuit in approximately December. So that is the current status of the rule and the litigation, and I think be happy to address any questions anyone might have.
Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any questions at the moment. Karen, do you have any?
Sure. So, Chris, I mean, with the new administration, you know, reopening the rulemaking, do you think there's a chance that they're going to try to split the baby at all and move the goalposts a little bit from where they were prior to the Obama rule, but not maybe that far?
Yeah, that's a great question, Karen. And definitely the notice of proposed rulemaking that was just issued in June raises that prospect. The reasoning that the DOL gives for rescinding the rule is in part to allow it to consider the court's ruling in our case and some of the other arguments that have been made against the existing rule. And definitely the notice of proposed rulemaking leaves the door open to the department coming back with a different proposed rule down the line. And so, you know, our thought is, although the current notice of proposed rulemaking is really limited just to rescinding the rule, it really is a good opportunity for employers and organizations that would be impacted at all by any revision. This is a good opportunity for them to go ahead and get comments in the record now regarding, you know, how any future rule should be shaped in light of their concerns about potential impacts on their ability to get legal advice, on their willingness to seek legal advice, and the various other issues that arose during the litigation under this rule.
Great. Laura, do we have other questions? Or
We can take our first audience question now.
Hi, it's...
Go ahead, caller.
Hi, it's Hal Coxon and the First Tuesday Group here, Karen. We're thrilled to hear your voice. Let me just ask a question. The reverse rulemaking under the Administrative Procedures Act, it's not sufficient for a new administration to simply say, we changed our mind, we're a new administration. They have to engage in reasoned analysis, which, of course, however the Labor Department comes out on this, will likely be challenged by the AFL-CIO and other unions. Would you agree that it's imperative for all trade associations and many companies to submit comments to provide reasoned analysis to support rescinding the rule? Because we know that the AFL-CIO has already sent a form letter to all of its members to ask them to weigh in. So would you agree that it's important for all of us to respond?
Absolutely, Hal, and that's very well put. And in fact, one of the reasons that the district court gave in our case for finding the new rule arbitrary and capricious was the court's finding that the DOL didn't adequately explain why it was issuing the new rule in the first place. And so I think you're exactly right that that we want to make sure that the rescission doesn't suffer from that same defect.
Again,
continue. Is that in the decision from Judge Cummings, didn't he say, and Secretary Acosta quote, the phrase that the rule as proposed was defective to its core?
Absolutely. Yes, that was one of the key phrases from his opinion, finding that by reading the exception out of the statute entirely, it was a completely defective, the DOL's analysis of the advice exception was completely defective and well beyond its statutory authority.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. I'll make a brief announcement. Our next Teleform conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Wednesday, July 12th at 12 noon. The call will be an update on net neutrality, specifically focusing on a layered model of adjudication and enforcement with the FTC, DOJ, and state AGs. That call will feature Rosalind Layton, visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and our moderator, Alex O'Culiar, partner at Orrick, Harrington, and Sutcliffe. Reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleform calls and to consult the full schedule of our upcoming calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded Teleform calls you may have missed. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing an audience question, Karen, do you have another? Karen, I think you might be on mute.
Sorry. Chris, my only other question was, was there any sort of issue the department was able to point to on this rulemaking or, you know, under the Obama administration or even the current one where all of a sudden there was some issue that was presented that they thought this exemption needed to be narrowed?
You know, and not really. And that was one of the things Judge Cummings pointed out was that the department, despite the rule when it issued, the persuader rule was something like 120 pages long. It was extremely long. And the district court pointed out that nowhere in the rule did the department ever explain why it was changing the interpretation now, that the interpretation of the prior interpretation of the advice exemption had been in place for 50 years. It was a clear rule. As I mentioned, the rule focused on whether or not a lawyer or consultant had direct contact with employees. So it was a very easily understandable rule to use to determine whether a consultant was engaging in reportable activity or not. And it had worked well. The judge pointed out that DOL never explained why it was making this change now. I not to get into political speculation, but there was some suggestion that it was really just a political move, and that it was something that perhaps union organizers had wanted for a long time, in light of the fact that unionization in the private sector has declined steadily over the years, and that perhaps this was something that union organizers could benefit from by adopting a rule that essentially would chill lawyers in particular from assisting employers in responding to union campaigns. But there was nothing ever identified by the DOL as a reason for why it was making this change and why it was making it now.
I'll make a final call for audience questions. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any, Karen, do you have any other questions?
I'm good. I think this was very helpful. Thank you.
Great. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Before we adjourn, let me ask if Chris, if he has any closing remarks. Do you have any?
No, I don't, but thank you very much for the opportunity to join you this afternoon.
Great. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.